I'm told I don't need the microphone. Can you hear me pretty well at the back there? Great. I have a little microphone, which I think is carrying the task. Yes, can you hear me back there? Great. It's a great honor for me to be visiting this wonderful institution. I'm so taken with your campus, the wonderful students I met, your wonderful manuscript collection, which I got to visit in the library, to do with Ethiopian religious manuscripts. I've just had a wonderful visit, and I can't thank you enough. I'm very grateful to Nick for inviting me here and being such a gracious host. Chris Freeman found time to take me around and give me a tennis lesson on the indoor courts here. And finally, I should thank a close friend who I've gotten to know over the last couple of years, and I think you know very well as a journalist and a reporter. He spoke at your commencement a year ago, Fred de Sam Lazaro. He and his wife have been very gracious during this visit, and so this feels like a coming home to me. Thank you. I must ask, how many of you have had dinner before coming here? Well, that's what I feared, because the general principle is that your blood supply is now going south, and I have to try and speak to your cognitive mind. So this is a daunting task for me, but I must confess that I am grateful for one thing, and that is I am the only speaker tonight. I've had the misfortune of being at several symposia where I've always had to follow on someone who's been extraordinary before me. And the last time this happened, or the most memorable time, was at the University of Iowa at a conference not on medicine but on the narrative voice. And the speaker before me was the University of Iowa's professor of religion. He was a rabbi. He stood about 6'6". He had a wonderful flowing beard, a beautiful baritone voice. And he had such a presence that when he got up there, I thought the podium would catch fire or the microphone would change into a snake. And he began with the incredible proposition that the narrative experience began with the moment that God spoke to Moses on the mountain. And he held forth on this topic in the most erudite fashion for 1 hour, had the audience spellbound, sat down to thunderous applause, and then I was introduced. And I got up there and I said that I knew nothing about what God had said to Moses on the mountain, but I'd heard this apocryphal story, which I'm about to repeat to you, as to what Moses said to the restless masses below. Moses said, "I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is that it's down to 10. The bad news is that adultery is still in there." I've titled my talk tonight somewhat ambitiously, "The Search for Meaning in a Medical Life, in My Medical Life." And I'm hoping, by a series of readings and a linking narrative, to come to this question of where does meaning reside? And I feel I'm preaching to the converted, but I'd like to share with you the lesson I learned from a very intense experience with HIV in a small town in Tennessee. And I hope to arrive at an answer that I hope will be as helpful for you as it has been for me. And I'd like to leave plenty of time at the end for your questions, your comments about any aspect of this that you find interesting. Perhaps the best place for me to begin is with the title of my book, My Own Country, which was taken from a poem that I much admired, a poem by Malcolm Cowley from a collection called The Blue Giunietta. And the particular poem was called The Long Voyage, and the first stanza goes like this: "Not that the pines were darker there, nor mid-May dogwood brighter there, nor swifts more swift in summer air, but it was my own country." And it was my hope that when I picked this title, that it would resonate for the reader at many different levels. At one level, it was about my own search for a place to call home. Because as you heard, I was actually born in Ethiopia, but of Indian parents who went there as school teachers and met and married there. And I had actually all my early education there, and even began medical school. And then civil war broke out, a cruel Stalin-like dictator took over. Many people were hurt, including your wonderful curator at the library, Gethachew Haile. I fled, And I came to America and I worked in a succession of nursing homes as an orderly, trying to get back into medicine. And at some point, after about a year of this, the Indian government took me in, which was somewhat paradoxical because I had spent most of my life in Africa, knew India only as the place that we vacationed with my parents. And so India was not my own country, and yet it was. It was certainly my parents' country. And I completed my education there and then did my residency training in Tennessee and Boston. And when I finally returned to Johnson City, Tennessee, population 50,000, to be an infectious disease specialist, I felt that I had finally found my own country. I had found the particular geography that would define, if not me, at least define my children. But I wanted that title to also have a lot to do with the patients I wound up seeing who, as you'll hear, were hometown boys, but in a funny way, they were more alien in that town than I would ever be. When I got to Johnson City, Tennessee, I had, this was in 1985, I had just lived through an extraordinary period in the history of HIV in this country. Some of you in this room are old enough to remember that. I was a fellow in infectious diseases at the old Boston City Hospital when we began to see young men, primarily young men, coming in with bizarre infections. Pneumocystis pneumonia, cryptococcal meningitis, disseminated mycobacterial infection, all of which we'd seen before, but always in the context of very well-defined immune dysfunction from a transplant or leukemia. But these young men had no such explanation. And I remember the fear mingled with excitement as we took care of these patients, recognizing fully that we were seeing a brand new disease and not knowing exactly how it was spread. And I remember the moment of great triumph one morning, picking up the Boston Globe and reading that the cause for this mysterious illness had been discovered by Gallo and Montagnier, or Montagnier and Gallo, whoever you want to believe. I believe Montagnier, actually. But I remember how short-lived that excitement was, because within just a few weeks of finding this virus and quickly developing a blood test to check blood, it became apparent that for every one young man I was taking care of in the hospital, there were perhaps 100 to 200 others out there in the community carrying this virus. And everything we had learned about this illness in that short time suggested that they would also have the same inexorable decline that we had seen in our patients, uniformly fatal. But I was leaving Boston. I was going to Johnson City, Tennessee, population 50,000. And all the experts, all the pundits, thought that I would see perhaps one HIV-infected person every other year, or maybe none at all, because HIV was very much an urban condition. And when I first got there, I certainly did not see any HIV, and I occupied myself doing all the traditional infectious disease things, taking care of tuberculosis and infections in leukemics and so on. And I wanted to read you one encounter from my pre-AIDS period. And I'm predisposed to read this because Nick Hayes has commented on this particular anecdote. Wednesday afternoon was my time to see private patients in the university physician's office. One afternoon, I found myself in an exam room with Mrs. T, a prim and proper lady belonging to what I thought of as the Blue Hair and Mink Stole Society. She exuded the permanence of colonnades and war memorials. I often saw her type heading for church on Sunday mornings while I made my way to the Kiwanis Park tennis courts. Mrs. T was in her early 50s, handsome and slender. She kept her fur-colored jacket on during our interview. I blamed the Chanel No. 5 perfume she wore for lulling me into inattention, so much so that when she pulled out the envelope, whose torn end was much folded over and held with a paperclip, and when she said there was something she wanted to show me, I almost let her spill the envelope's contents onto the paper runway of the examining table before I cried, "Hold it, ma'am. Do you mind if I peek into the envelope first?" When I looked within, all I saw were tiny brown particles. She had referred to them as growths that she had extracted from her pubic hair. But just as I feared, the little boogers were moving. "Hold it, ma'am," I said. Do you see how these are alive? Mrs. T turned pale. She brought her glasses up from the chain on her neck and she peered into the slit of the envelope with me. Now her hand came to her mouth. I thought they were moving, she said, but then I thought it was my glasses or that I was dizzy or something. Those are lice, ma'am, crab lice. Do you itch? I itched something awful, she said. Blood was now rushing to her face and I felt tremendously sorry for her embarrassment. My guess was that her husband had given it to her. I took a deep breath and I asked, is your husband itching too? I doubt it, Mrs. T said, lifting her head up and bravely looking me in the eye, a firmness and resolve coming to her face. No, she said, I'm the one that's itching. I'm responsible for getting it. After a pause, she added, if you would prescribe for me the appropriate treatment, I would be very grateful. But there was a question that I had to ask, a question that despite my several years now in infectious diseases, I found myself embarrassed to ask this refined lady. Ma'am, is it your practice to use a condom with your partner? Yes, she said, almost in a whisper, turning red again, her eyes examining the back of her hands. She looked up now, a little sparkle in her eye. But it didn't help me, did it? She said. What could I have done to prevent getting this? Worn a raincoat? Her face broke into a wonderful smile and I had to laugh. The tension in the room was dissipated. Think of it this way, ma'am, I said. The condom did work. It may have prevented things like gonorrhea, syphilis, AIDS. She turned pale when I said AIDS. If you like, I can test you for those things, I said. She shook her head. Then don't worry, I said. The crab lice we shall take care of forthwith. Shall I prescribe a double dose, one for your partner? That won't be necessary, she said. As far as I'm concerned, I hope they eat him alive. It turned out that all the predictions as to how much HIV I would see in that town were horribly off base because I saw my first patient within just a few months. And then a month or so after that, I saw my second patient. And then suddenly, this became not just a monthly event, but a fortnightly event, and then a weekly event. I was seeing a new patient just about every week. And in just a short time, a few years, I had accumulated almost 100 persons with HIV infection, which was pretty incredible for a town of 50,000. It was 100-fold more than the CDC had predicted for areas like ours. And I remember feeling very besieged by this because I was the only one taking care of these patients. And I had the sense then that I was actually dealing with two diseases. There was the virus on the one hand and everything you and I know this virus can do to the human body. But the second disease that I was dealing with this, was the metaphor that traveled with the virus. And it was a metaphor of shame, of secrecy. And in many cases I felt that the metaphor was in many ways stronger, more potent than the disease. I had one young man who I had the misfortune to tell him that his HIV test came back positive. And I spent as much time as I could with him, counseling him and trying to encourage him. I asked him to come back and see me the next day so we could chat some more. But that night he went to a nightclub and he engineered a shootout with the police. We now have a name for this. We call this death by police or suicide by police. But I always thought of him as having been killed by the metaphor, having been killed by what it meant to have that disease in that small town. And so he went out in this blaze of glory in an attempt to erase the metaphor. I never described him in my book because that was such a well-known event in our town that to do so would have basically identified him and undone the very thing that he had so cruelly done to himself in an attempt to erase the metaphor. The metaphor was so huge, this metaphor of shame and secrecy, it was so big that I felt that it had tainted me, that I had lost all identity in that town other than that of being the AIDS doctor. I felt that there were patients who probably would have come to see me but kept away because of this metaphor and because of who they might encounter in my office. Even amongst my fellow physicians, I was beginning to feel somewhat isolated. I remember a pulmonary physician, his wife, telling my wife that Every time I called him, he cringed because he didn't know if I was about to ask him to do a bronchoscopy on one of his patients. And I must say, to his credit, he never communicated that to me. He always did what needed to be done promptly. And yet, what she had told us sort of revealed the kind of a dread that I was also being viewed with simply because of my specialty. At one point, I needed to have a special Hickman catheter put into the subclavian vein of one of my patients to feed him. And I asked a surgical colleague who was my age, and we had been chief residents together, done a lot of things together. I asked him to put the catheter in, and he balked. He declined to do it. And as I was scratching my head, wondering what I should do next, the nurse paged me to say that the patient had been taken to the operating room, and the senior partner, who was in his 60s, was doing the procedure. And I was, of course, astonished and very grateful. I went to him after the surgery, and I said, "Thank you so much for doing this. I'm delighted you did it, because your partner wouldn't." And he said, "Son, the day that I begin to judge my patients by their behavior, by their activities, is the day that I give up medicine." So this was AIDS was a cure. For the students in this room, it's very difficult for you all to imagine what a litmus test AIDS was for our society and for medical society. People reacted either very badly or very well, and the lines were very, very clearly demarcated. There was another kind of isolation that was going on, and that is within the community of Indian physicians, who I liked tremendously, and there were a lot of Asian physicians in that small town, as there are, I'm sure, in many small towns around here. Within that community of Asian physicians who were older than I was and who I liked, I looked up to as uncles almost, even within that community I was beginning to feel somewhat isolated. And I wanted to read you a passage that has to do with that secondary isolation within my own community, so to speak. A new fad has swept the Johnson City Indian community. Instead of inviting people to each other's houses for dinner, families were now renting out the gym of the Ashley Academy, a private school, so as to host dinner for 60 to 100 people. In one fell swoop, a family could reciprocate for every dinner they'd ever been invited to over the previous year, and in doing so, they also racked up the certainty of invitations for the rest of the year, a year that could be spent at leisure until they were back in the debit column again. As more families followed this trend, the dinners took on a surreal quality. The same gym, the same crowd, almost the same food, only the host changed. The women had as usual gravitated to one side, the men to the other, and the children were playing noisily in the middle. There was a constant din in the room from all the voices. I moved around the room, greeting people I had seen just 2 weeks ago in the same gym. The teenage girls buzzed and whispered together, staying in their one geographic spot all night. The teenage boys stood sullen together on the men's side of the room, and they looked displeased at being made to come to these functions. Among the men, the pecking order was very clear. Doctors ruled over engineers, who lorded it over everyone else. The motel owner's status really depended on how successful he was as an entrepreneur. But then financial success was really at the root of the hierarchy among the doctors. Surgeons, particularly thoracic surgeons, were treated as the maharajas, everyone rising and bowing when this persona entered the room. Plastic surgery and urology were a notch below thoracic surgery. And even if the urologist made more money, there was something just a little unclean about the idea of urology, what with working with urine and all that. It had tinges of untouchability. Then followed the cardiologists and the gastroenterologists and the other procedural medical specialists. Needless to say, on this ranking, being an infectious disease specialist was equivalent to being a bathroom sweeper. To have made the choice of the specialty of infectious diseases was in this circle considered akin to buying at full price a motel that any Patel could have told you was going belly up and that you could have bought for a budget at foreclosure. Tonight, as always, I was the recipient of much advice. Most of it was on how to make money, since I clearly wasn't making any. In the competition to build a larger and fancier house, I wasn't even in the race. I was renting from the VA, a heinous crime from the point of view of an Indian community that saw land acquisition as a primal necessity. But what about my oak trees, I wanted to say? What about the bed of red salvia I have in front? I knew the answer. It would be, what about equity? I acted as if money meant less to me than it did to them, a childish reflex. This was, of course, not true. I valued money and would not have minded a ton of it. Actually, in my original manuscript, I think I used the words a shitload of it, but my editor, not being from the South, changed that. I valued money and would not have minded a ton of it, but I didn't feel that I had to do something different in medicine just for that reason. I was every bit as well-trained, just as talented, I like to think, as the doctors who made 20 times what I made. The monetary disparity was not due to their skill or their intrinsic worth, even though at times I think they succumbed to this delusion. It was due to a payment system that placed greater value on procedural specialties than on those without them. Ah, but in Sweden, I would say, when I grew tired of being needled about my specialty, in Sweden, thoracic surgeons and infectious disease specialists get the same salary. And you know what? If the Democrats win the next election, this was always guaranteed to produce a loud outcry that I delighted in, because there were no stauncher Republicans than the Indian doctors of East Tennessee. I tired of this after a while. I tired of the talk of stock options and mutual funds and the benefits of incorporating. I drifted over to the teenage boys. To them, I was a hero of sorts. Not only did I not drive a Mercedes-Benz, not only had I never owned a new car, I rode a motorcycle and gave them rides, not necessarily with their daddy's permission. And on top of that, I took care of AIDS patients. Whatever it was their daddies did, there was no personal danger. In truth, there was no personal danger in what I did. But that evening, I did not fight the St. George the Dragon Slayer metaphor. With a little encouragement, I found myself waxing eloquent about AIDS care, telling these teenagers how it had enriched my life, changed its direction. Some of the teenage girls shuffled over. I marshaled a passionate argument against Ronald Reagan, deliberately trying to plant a seed of dissension in their family. I told them a risque joke, how the urologist who removed Reagan's prostate was asked later by Reagan if all was well, would the plumbing now work well? Everything is perfect, the urologist said. Your bladder is fine, your penis is 100%, you can go out and fuck the country for another 4 years. I wonder if that word has ever been spoken in this hallowed place. I assure you, I'm reading from the text, that I'm staying true to it. The mystery of why this town should have so much HIV infection turned out not to be such a mystery after all. It was not because the town was a hotbed of sexual intrigue, which it was, by the way, but that wasn't the reason. Instead, it appeared that I had stumbled onto an elaborate paradigm of migration, which went something like this. A young man grows up in a small town and leaves for all the same reasons that you and I leave small towns. Jobs, education, opportunity. But in their case, they were also leaving because they were gay, or thought they might be, and did not think that they could live that lifestyle in that town under the close scrutiny of their friends and their relatives and their families. And so they had made their brave journey to the big city. And tragically, at some point, often after many years, tragically, even as they found themselves, the virus found them. And they were now returning to their hometowns, a much more visible return, returning because they were ill or because they'd contracted the virus. And there I was at the tail end of this migration, witnessing far more people coming back than anyone had predicted. And I saw this paradigm most clearly in the persona of a patient I call Hobart in the book. Hobart remembers at the age of 6 walking in the schoolyard with his brother who was 8, and having his brother turn to him and say, "Must you walk that way?" He was only 6 years old. And it became a very important metaphor for him, one of many that were pointed out to him, so that by the time he was 18, he'd begun to feel as if he were an alien in that town. And so he left as part of this general exodus for jobs, for schooling, for opportunity, but he left for San Francisco, perhaps the one place in the country where the way he walked, the way he talked, his choice in clothing, his taste in art, and ultimately his sexuality, were not about to attract any attention. He had a wonderful life in San Francisco. He worked in a 5-star hotel. He wore a tuxedo every day. And there was a moment in this paradigm where the father, or the parents, find out that their son is gay, if they haven't known it already. In his case, it came when he went home on a vacation, and he was riding with his father, who was a preacher, a Baptist preacher in that town. He was riding with his father in the car, and he decided to tell his father. And he said, Daddy, there's something that I want to tell you. Daddy, I'm gay. I've had these feelings in me ever since I was a small boy, ever since I can remember. Daddy, if you want to stop the car now, I'll be happy to get out. And his father said, Son, why would I want you to get out? I don't love homosexuality, but I love you, and I would never tell you to get out of my house, out of my family. And then the father went on to say an extraordinary thing that haunts me, which was he said to Hobart that he had known or suspected this for some time. And Hobart said to his father, Daddy, if you knew, why didn't you say something? I've been living with this burden from the time I was a small boy. I wish you'd said something. And the father said, well, son, what would I have said to you? If you were not gay and I suggested you might be, it would have only hurt you. In any case, they made their peace with each other, and he told his mother. And many years passed, and one morning he woke up with severe left-sided chest pain and went to San Francisco General Hospital. Ironically, was taken care of by a close friend of mine. And all the usual suspects were considered, and no one could figure out this mysterious, severe chest pain until the third day when he broke out with vesicles, like little dewdrops on rose petals, and this was, of course, shingles. And at the same time, it became apparent that his HIV test was positive. And he had a very complicated episode of shingles, or herpes zoster infection, complicated by inflammation of the lining of the spinal cord and the brain, to the point that he was in the hospital for 4 to 6 weeks, barely survived that illness. And when he came out, he found that his job was gone. The apartment, which he had so carefully decorated with his prints, his art, he'd been evicted from that. And all his belongings were in the basement of a friend's apartment, a friend who was also sick and in the hospital. And so, having no other recourse, he made the call to his parents that he had AIDS. He was coming home. And there I was at the tail end of that journey. And to me, living in Johnson City at that time, it was extraordinary to hear these tales from these young men coming back. The tale of the utter devastation taking place in closed gay communities like the Castro in San Francisco, the Village in New York, the Fenway in Boston, Peachtree in Atlanta, where everyone you knew, every trader you traded with, every person you saw on the street, every neighbor was either infected or in the hospital or dead. It was really more than my mind could comprehend because I was living in Johnson City, Tennessee. And when he came to Tennessee, this was 87, 86, you must remember this was a time when we had absolutely nothing to offer people with HIV. There was no drugs, so there were no drugs. AZT was on the horizon. And I took care of him as best I could. Our goal was mainly to prevent some of these other infections. And there came a point when he suddenly began to develop very high fever, almost 9 months into his stay there. And I admitted him to the hospital, and I ran every test I could think of, trying to elucidate the cause of this fever, but I could not find out what was going on. And on the third day or fourth day, he finally turned to me and he said, Abraham, I've had enough. I don't want you to do any more testing. Let me go home. And I agreed, and I think both of us knew that he was going to die, but I just could not go on with testing and prodding him because it seemed so cruel. It wasn't clear that if I found something, I would have anything to do about it. I would have anything in my armamentarium to help him. And so I let him go home, and he and I both knew he was going to die. And a few days before he died, he called me up and he said, Abraham, when I die, if you like, you can come to my house after I'm dead and take some biopsies of my organs, and that way you'll know what I had. And I think he knew that I'd been doing that quite a bit because I could not find pathologists willing to do autopsies. And I promised him that I would do that. And about 2 days before he died, his father came to see me to pick up a prescription for morphine solution to help Hobart rest. He told me that Hobart would ask his father to come and lie down with him and hug him just as when he was a little boy. They would stay that way for hours. And he said to his father, "Daddy, I love you. I hope you never grow old and die." And Mr. Carter replied, "Son, if I die today, I don't mind. Because of my belief in the Lord, I feel I will never die. But what about you, Hobart? Is everything all right with you and the Lord?" "Daddy, it was not for the longest time, but now it is." It was at this point that he called his brother, Jake, in Germany, and asked him for forgiveness. And Jake was puzzled. Forgiveness for what? He said, "Forgiveness for anything I've done to you." He made a similar phone call to me to ask me to excuse him from any grief that he had caused me. I assured him that he had caused me none. I'll read the rest of this section. On a Saturday morning, the call came that Hobart had died. I went over to the hospital and I picked up some true-cut biopsy needles and small bottles of formalin. This was his idea. In death, he had wanted to give me some clues as to what had gone on from an infectious disease point of view. I drove to the house in Bristol where the Carters lived, a 30-minute drive. Outside the house, neighborhood children were playing. They paused to watch me enter the Carters' home. Did these children know that a death had taken place? Did they know that a child just like them had attempted an escape, tried to create a new life, but after just a few years had it cut short? The house was neatly furnished with a gleaming white sofa in the living room and pictures of Hobart and Jake on the coffee table. Mr. Carter rose to greet me, gracious as ever. "Praise the Lord, Doctor, he's out of his misery," he said to me. Mrs. Carter sat heavily on the couch. She looked up but said nothing. In his bedroom, Hobart lay on his back, his head slightly to one side, his mouth open, his eyes open. His fringe of hair had grown long and wispy since I last saw him. I pulled the sheet away from his body, which was lean and emaciated. The unremittent fever had consumed the body, had burnt it down to this stringy remnant. There was a loud sound of sobbing in the next room and the sounds of children laughing and playing outside. Hobart's face was incredibly sad, the eyebrows raised quizzically. I put on gloves. I percussed down his chest to find the liver, and I settled on an interspace between two ribs. I pushed the biopsy needle in. I felt it pop through skin and slide into the liver. I advanced the hollow inner blade. I pulled the whole thing out and then held the needle tip over the bottle of formalin. A tiny worm-like core of tissue slid out of the needle into the bottle. A small victory here. This virus had killed Hobart, but it was not going anywhere from here but to formalin or to the crematorium. There's a reason that I read you that particular anecdote, and it's because it was when I was at his bedside that I could clearly see this paradigm of migration. I remember being tremendously affected by the sight of his body. To this day, there's something dislocating for me to see a body outside the hospital setting. But I was affected by his body because he looked so Christ-like. His hair had grown long and wispy. He had a beard. His diaper looked like a loincloth. But even more than his body, I remember looking around the room and realizing that this was his childhood room. This was where he'd grown up, with a lot of love from his parents. And these icons on the wall of this room, on the walls of this room, were the icons of his childhood, a picture of Christ at Gethsemane, a needlepoint verse framed in cedar. And yet, these were not his icons. His icons were in a box in a friend's basement in San Francisco, awaiting the hope of his return that she would never make. And I could suddenly see how this child had grown up in that house, feeling all the love in the world from his parents, and yet feeling as if it were not his own country, feeling like an alien in that little town. And he had made his brave escape to the big city, found himself, but tragically the virus had found him, and now he was back to this room, again back to his loving parents, who took magnificent care of him. And yet it must have seemed the most cruel failure in his life, in the world, to be back in that room, the same room that he had tried to escape. And that evening I went home and I drafted a scientific paper, which has become something of a classic, much referenced, describing this paradigm of migration. And when it came out, I got letters from physicians all over the country saying, this is exactly what we're seeing in our small town, and nobody's giving us the money or the resources to take care of it. But even as I wrote that scientific article, I felt that the cold and unimaginative language of science didn't begin to describe this tragic journey, didn't begin to describe the heartache of these families as they live through this again and again. I didn't begin to describe my own grief at seeing this, witnessing this time and time again. And I resolved that I would do something more with it. I didn't know there would be this particular book. I want to come back to the proposition I began with, which is, where does meaning reside in a secular life, in a physician's life? If my book, I'm going to try and explain that for you, the meaning concept. If my book has been extraordinarily successful, and when I say successful, I don't mean sales. I don't mean the movie that was made out of it. When I say successful, I mean the outpouring of letters from families, from people who have AIDS, who've lost people to AIDS, that have come to me. If my book has been extraordinarily successful, I think it's because, paradoxically, in these tragic stories, there is an element of triumph and victory. And I know you're looking at me and saying, how in the world can there be triumph and victory in the story of Hobart that you just read to me? Well, let me try and explain that for you. All of us in this room, you and I, all of us are going to die. It's not something that you dwell on, and certainly on an occasion like this we should not dwell on it. But if you were one of my patients and you just found out you had HIV, the thought of death was something that you could not push out of your mind. And I was witnessing this, and it was as if these patients had been scooped off the footpath of life and put into this crucible where all the reactions of life were speeded up and there was only so much enzyme and substrate before the whole thing stopped. And I've had the benefit or the misfortune to peek into these compressed lives, not just in Johnson City, but also in Iowa, and also now in El Paso for more than a decade. And it's extraordinary to me how in that crucible, one emotion, more than any other, leaps out. And it's the emotion that says, what has been the meaning of my life? Now that too is a question that you and I ask ourselves. But we also spend a lot of time postponing the answer to that question. Thinking, well, I'll find out meaning. Meaning will come when I get admitted to St. John's. Or meaning will come when I graduate. Or meaning will come when I get into medical school. Or meaning will come when I become a brain surgeon. Or meaning will come with my marriage, and often it does. Or meaning will come with my first child, and often it does. Or meaning will come with my big boat, or my small plane, or my ski chalet. On and on we go, postponing the answer to this very important question. But for my young patients, the answer could not be postponed. They had to have an answer, and they had to have it then because they were dying. And the wonderful thing for me as a witness to this was that most of them found an answer. And not only that, the answer was fairly consistent. And not only that, I think it's an answer that you and I can use. So let me not be evasive. Let me tell you what the answer was. This reminds me of a program that someone sent me by email where this little icon pops up on your screen and it says, click here for the meaning of life. And when you go to click on it, it scoots across the screen. And you cannot nail it down. I won't be that evasive. I will tell you what their answer was. When young men at the tail end of their lives asked themselves, where does meaning reside? They found that meaning did not reside in good looks, money, power, reputation. None of these things held up at the end of a lifetime. Instead, they found that meaning ultimately resided in the successful relationships that they had negotiated over a lifetime, particularly with parents. I can't tell you how many young men said to me, Abraham, I would never wish this disease on my worst enemy. I wouldn't wish it on Jesse Helms. And yet, in a funny way, this disease is the best thing that happened to me. Because but for this disease, I would have spent 20 years in the big city. I would have gotten the call one day that my father was ill. I would have jetted down for the funeral and spent another 20 years pursuing all the things I thought were important, never understanding that on my deathbed, this connection with my parents would be the thing I would so treasure. I heard parents say the same thing. Abraham, this son of ours was lost to us. We never understood it. He was so talented, he was so this, but he was gone from us. And because of this terrible disease which will take him away, if we can count on one blessing out of it, it's that we understood this child. He's back in our fold. We've come to understand him and connect with him again. And on our deathbeds, we will have that satisfaction. I know I'm not explaining this very well, so I want to close by reading you a letter which fittingly is not my words, but the words of the people that you and I serve. This was a letter that was sent to me by a woman who admired my book, whose son had died of AIDS. And the son had written her this letter, and he'd arranged for her to get this letter 1 month, 30 days after he died, because he felt that she needed at least that time to get over the acute grief and understand the message. And he seems to say, so much better than I'm struggling to say, this business about me. So let me close by reading this, and then I'll be happy to take your comments or questions. So here goes, a letter from son to mother. Dear Mom, this last part of my life could have been very unpleasant, but it wasn't. In fact, Mother, in many ways this has been the best part of my life, because I've had the opportunity to get to know my family again. A chance that very few people have, and even fewer take advantage of. Mom, I had a wonderful life, full of adventure and travel, and I loved every minute of it, but I probably never would have slowed down enough to really appreciate all of you if it hadn't been for this illness. That's the silver lining in this very, very dark cloud. Mother, I've had such a wonderful life that it seems almost tacky for me to express any regrets. Nevertheless, there are some things I wish I could have done. Number one, I'd love to have been mayor of Key West. And he goes on with a wonderful laundry list of things that he would have loved to do. But then he says, but Mother, when you get right down to it, I would have to live several hundred years to fulfill all the dreams I had. I've done pretty well with the time allotted to me, so I have no regrets. I feel sorry for the people who die at whatever age, who haven't had the chance in life to fulfill their dreams. That, Mother, is the real tragedy. Mother, if anyone ever asks you if I went to heaven, tell them this: I just came from there. No place could conceivably be as wonderful as where I've spent these last 32 years. I'll miss it. I'll miss you, Mother. I'm so glad we made good use of this time to get to know each other again. Ladies and gentlemen, and particularly students at this wonderful institution, make good use of your time. Thank you very much. I'm never sure that I can get through that letter. It's a very difficult letter to read.